So when we look at this plan, which is really a working document and well done, it's about let us be safe in the water, but it also says on that first executive page, but somehow we've lost our way. Water is taking too many lives. What we'd like to say today, Mayor, is tomorrow is going to be May 15th and is Water Safety Day. So as mayor, a waterman, avid surfer, can you share some hopeful news and where we're at? What are we doing right? Where do you see the opportunity for us to grow as a community when it comes to ocean safety?
Well, Water Safety Day is like anything else. It's to raise awareness and educate the public of where all of our vulnerabilities are. You know, being that we are an island state and we're surrounded by water and the beach is so easily accessible, it's to let people know the sobering statistics that there are a lot of people that live on this island that unfortunately have never learned the basic instructions to swim, just to tread water, just from a safety perspective, how to stay calm and just and float until help can arrive. I would say the positive out of all of this is I really feel like our Ocean Safety Bureau, our Kauai Fire Department, our Kauai Lifeguard Association that's made up of community volunteers that help support our Ocean Safety Bureau through the Junior Lifeguard Program. And just recently, we had an internship program where some of these junior lifeguards got to actually work at a tower with our ocean safety officers, are leading the way as far as educating awareness. You know, I want to thank the Department of Transportation Airports Division because I get so much comment from visitors and locals alike that, hey, we saw you up there with your chief of the Ocean Safety Bureau talking about water safety. And, you know, I think the next level is to see if we can actually get it on these airplanes as visitors are arriving. It's something that I think collectively we can find a partner. And once we find an airline that is willing to educate their visitors, I think it'll just catch on.
Ian Couch is a water safety officer for the world's toughest row.
It should almost be part of, right, I'm going out today. It takes you 2 minutes to go, what happens if something goes wrong? How am I going to cope with it? What's it going to feel like? One of the examples we use is our boats capsize sometimes. We try and get the crews to prepare for that. And we had a great crew. They rowed into here, actually. They set the female pair's record. A brilliant pair. They've done the same on the Atlantic. And they phoned us up and said, we're sure we're going to capsize. We feel it. The conditions are such. Right. Let's go through procedures. What are you going to do? How's it going to be like? And it's not just a really dry black and white, this is what it's going to be like. What's it going to feel like, sound like, smell like? What's it going to taste like? We call it emotional inoculation. And try and get as much of that fear done through your visualization. And then sure enough, a couple of hours later, they phoned us up and went, it happened, we capsized, we're so happy, because everything worked for them.
Emotional inoculation.
It's what they did. And it's the thing, you go through things as much as you can, and if you can practice it for real time, you practice it. But some things you just can't do, so you just have to do the visualization of it. And you do the breathing exercises, and you calm yourself down. It might be that when that thing happens, the plan you have isn't the right plan. But you've already had a thought process. You're far less likely to freeze in shock if you've already started thinking about what you're going to do. So it's just building that awareness and try and make it routine before you go on the water.
Professor Mike Tipton is a distinguished expert in human and applied physiology at the University of Portsmouth.
And then there were some statistics published that said that 2/3 of those that drowned in the UK died within 2 meters of a safe refuge. And 2/3 of them were regarded as good swimmers. Now, a good swimmer doesn't die of hypothermia when they're a few feet from safe refuge. Something very quick is taking their life. An adult human being won't become hypothermic, even if they're just wearing normal clothing and in freezing cold water, in less than 30 minutes. So this clearly wasn't killing people. It wasn't hypothermia. And when you looked at the statistics of the deaths and you interrogated them, over 60% of people who died were dying in the first minute of immersion. And so we did some studies and we demonstrated that the gasp response that you see on initial immersion, followed by the uncontrollable hyperventilation, the sudden workload placed on the heart by the fact that, you know, the cold pushes the heart to work harder while shutting down all the blood flow to the periphery blood pressure shoots up. We call it cold shock, not because of the medical definition of shock, but because it's just a shocking experience. And we believe that actually it was cold shock that was killing most people. It was it was that first initial gasp of 2 to 3 liters that is uncontrollable. Now, if your head happens to be in the, under the water, is a wave breaking over your face, or you've fallen from a height, then not being able to hold your breath is the most dangerous of all of the responses that you can get on immersion. The lethal dose of salt water into the lung is about 1.5 liters for an average individual. The gasp response is 2 to 3 liters. So that very first breath is enough to cross the lethal dose for drowning. And many people don't even aspirate that much when they drown, as much as 1.5 liters.
But getting to the next issue, which you are a technological advocate, now you can tell us about what you have done for us as a community in a application called PulsePoint. How you got this available for us on Kauai, and how it works and how people can use it.
So PulsePoint, it's a 911 activated app that notifies users of cardiac emergencies nearby. So if there's someone having a heart attack, it notifies users of a cardiac emergency nearby. It also will let you know where there's a nearest AED. I'd heard about it from a lifeguard on Oahu. You know, he was telling me about it. And so, you know, so what I did was I did a lot of homework, and the groundwork for it was the idea behind it. So I found out as much information as I could and started to try and raise money and awareness for it. And to back up a little bit, you know, in the homework that I was doing, I found out that, and this is not a knock at our department, it's just the reality of where we live on Kauai, that our response time for EMS is between 7 and 20 minutes. And I'll just use Station 1 in Hanalei as an example.
Yeah.
So they cover North Ko'olau Road to Napali. If they're tied up on a call, you have to wait for Kaikia, which is in Kailia, to respond. So
it's a long way.
It could be upwards of 45 minutes to response. Your survivability for a CPR cardiac emergency, after 3 minutes, it starts to drop. We live in Waniha. My daughter was, I don't know, one-ish at the time when we started this. And so not selfishly, I mean, but kind of, sort of, it's, you know, it really hit home. It's like, if something were to happen and I'm not home, you know, it'd be great if somebody could help. And this app enables people, it enables first responders to get people's address. And my best friends, who are all firemen, they live right next to me, which is killer. I mean,
right.
You know, it's like being a kid again, right? Your friends are right down the street. I can walk down and see if they're home. But the reality is, too, is like, if something happens to Harper, you know, it's great having that network. And you can use that island-wide. And what this app does is it builds stronger communities.
On the phone line right now, we've got Chad Lissman.
And just like you're going to a Nini boat ramp, you just keep going. It's about 2 miles past that. The bad thing about it down there, there's no service. Once you hit that last stretch, you lose all service for phones and stuff. So those calls usually come in a little late.
Oh, that's interesting.
The trail from the Westin Hotel. Since they have cleared that trail and allow people and mark it, it's even on all trails. It's like a trail map app that people have. It has the trail in there. So the problem is when people walk down to these, to our beaches, especially with the reefs and the lagoons and stuff, is the prettiest spot is the dark blue water, and that's where they all want to go. And it's dark blue because it's deep. Usually that's where you're going to find all your strongest currents. All the water wants to go to that spot, so people see that, and that's where they want to swim. They don't want to swim in 2 feet of water. They want to swim that lush aqua color blue.
Oh, that's interesting. And, so the back channel is one of those areas. Is there other areas on the North Shore that you would say has that deep water that people are going to?
Well, that they can see, because when you walk down from that hotel, you know, it looks right. Beautiful. There's only one place you want to swim. So when you come down, you definitely head out in the wrong direction. And all the water helps you.
Well, tell me something about Nakamakai and its impact. You know, look back on how the program began. It began in 2008. And you were a leader in this work that the Water Safety Plan has talked about long before the policy caught up in creating this kind of culture. Can you tell us some more about this program, how it started, and where you are now with it?
Definitely. You know, I had the privilege of being a professional surfer since I was 16 years old. And through that professional career, traveling all over the world. And the biggest takeaway for me was how unique my upbringing was at Makaha Beach. Between the uncles and aunties and my own family giving me access to the ocean, you would automatically think everybody has the same thing, you know?
Yeah.
Especially as a kid on food stamps and always thinking, wow, we're poor, we don't have this, we don't have that. But the ability to have a career that took me to new places and see what was going on around the world made me look at home where as unique as it was. You know, nowhere else was like Makaha. Nowhere else was giving the nonstop daily immersion into watermen culture, whether it's fishing, diving, surfing, canoe surfing, all the various ocean activities. And that made me realize when I looked around Hawaii that there was a lot, you know, majority of our children were not getting the access to not only the ocean, but the cultural perspective of the ocean, which for me, it's super, super important because it instills kuleana. It also instills the responsibility and the reciprocal relationship that we have, that our kupuna teach us. You know, we don't just go to the ocean to take, we go to the ocean to live. And in order to live, we also have a responsibility to care for that ocean and the community that loves it. Through my work early on, I did not know all the statistics around the lack of swimming, the lack of access, but it definitely became very obvious and alarming to me that, wow, I mean, you know, because I'm diving into this, I'm getting access to what only Ocean Safety and the Department of Health are talking about. And ironically, at the time, the focus was being sponsored by the Hawaii Tourism Authority, so it was always slanted and leaning towards tourism, which I also thought was super alarming because the conversation at the time was talking about the drowning rates of tourists, and it was 45% of the drowning rate was tourists. And actually 55% of the drowning rate were local. But yet we were talking about the tourism side of the drowning only. And this privilege came because of my invitation to the ocean safety conferences through guys like Ralph Godo, who used to run the Ocean Safety Department for the city and county. And, you know, it took me time to understand what I needed to do and what was important because there wasn't any energy around it yet. So it's also, you know, for me to understand, like, whoa, I see this, I know this, and apparently I got to do something about this. I got to start to try and see how I can influence some change. And the conversation around that change, a lot of times I had to speak to what people could understand, you know, and so the drowning rates were very obvious to speak to what was important. And then while I was speaking about the obvious numbers and the obvious issues, I was inserting the fact that we have a cultural responsibility here as island people, where we live surrounded by ocean and we're neglecting, and I use that word very powerfully, we're neglecting to educate our children about this beautiful ocean that they have as a resource. We're not actually giving it to them. And meanwhile, we're having these staggering low swimming rates and drowning rates and terrible drowning rates. So, again, it was truly a privilege to witness what was missing here in Hawaii in the ocean, and then apply it to my work that I continue 17 years later.